This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 425 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from shuttersincpodcast.com.
And I'm not.
And you are not. You are Mr. Glyn Lavender from creativephotoworkshops.com.au. How are you?
Hey, you.
Hey, you.
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm a lot better than last week.
Why is that?
Well, I'm clothed for a start.
Always a bonus.
It's a bonus. It's much cooler down here today, so.
Yeah, right.
And it's also day one of school holidays. Well, school holidays finished yesterday. Day one of school going back today.
Right.
So, yeah, the kids are gone. I can relax. Problem is, here's the worst bit, though, Bruce, I have to tell you.
Yeah.
Kids went back today, started a new school. So my wife worked from home today so she could take them to and pick them up. Couldn't get a nap in.
I hate that.
I couldn't get back to my normal workflow because she would see that I don't do much. So I had to actually pretend to do some work today, which was, means I'll need twice as many naps tomorrow.
Right. Of course.
On a plus side, the kids' school is now so close. It's just under a two-minute car drive.
Oh, okay. That's walking distance.
Well, not for me.
So for two-minute car drive, it's probably a three-minute walk.
No, it's a 10-minute push bike ride.
Oh, okay.
Because they got little legs and small bikes and small wheels. Right. So it takes more pedals and takes further to get there because the wheels take – anyway. So the bizarrest of things I've got back – so to the kids old school, to get a car park for the school to pick up, you'd have to leave like 2 o'clock in the afternoon for a 3:10 pickup.
Right.
And then it takes on to get out of the school. You wouldn't get home till like, say, 20 to 4.
Wow.
Okay, so you've lost. You've lost, you know.
The best part of 2 hours.
Better part of 2 hours in the afternoon. And the mornings, let's say, 45, 50 minutes.
Yeah, right.
So you're looking almost 3 hours a day, let's say.
Yeah.
Just doing school drop-off, pick-off. Well, today I left for the school at 3:05.
Yeah.
For a 3:10 pickup, and I was 3 minutes early.
Right.
And I parked at the front of the school because there's no kids.
Nice.
So it's kind of bizarre. I'm kind of feeling a bit weird.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, things are back on track. The kids are gone. I can start to actually do some work for the first time in about 8 weeks, which is good because I'm starting to itch.
Yeah, right.
Now before we launch into this episode, I want to talk about the naming of the episode.
Oh, okay.
I want to dedicate the episode.
Right.
So, as I mentioned in last week's podcast, the lovely George Georgiadis is coming with me to Africa. Fabulous. Wonderful. Going to have a ball. Fabulous. Got a message from him during the week, and I haven't got my phone here to be able to read it out, but it was along the lines of, well, one, because he's now working out of Pakistan, we're the number one podcast in Pakistan for expatriate Australians, apparently.
Right.
Okay. Possibly being he's the only one. But either way, it doesn't matter. We've hit number one. But he also kind of, he says, it's not the kind of, he appreciated the mention on the show last week. He said, it's not quite the same as having an episode named after you, dedicated to. So this week, I would like to call this episode the Not the George Georgiadis episode.
Okay.
Because we're not having anyone come and say, I want you to name. No way, we're not that cheap. No one's going to just come along and ask to be named. It takes a lot more than that. So this is the Not the George Georgiadis episode.
Right.
Can we do that?
I'm sure we can manage that. Marvelous. If I can find the spelling.
That'll stick to him. Unless he cancels the trip, then. In other words. So what's on your plate this week, my friend? Have you done anything exciting?
No, I have not. But what we do need to promote is the fact that later in this episode, we're going to have a special guest. In this episode.
A special guest this episode.
Yes.
A little bit later on.
Yes.
Are we?
Ken with the can in the esky.
Who?
Hopefully he's got more than one can in the esky.
It's Cam.
If he's
got the cam in the esky, it's going to get – hey, people overseas don't know what an esky is, so you're doing yourself a disservice there. And then he's saying can instead of cam. Don't put your cameras in the esky because the cold will affect the batteries.
Yes.
The condensation is probably not very good either. We have the very lovely, and I mean this quite genuinely, just an all-around nice guy, Ken Kamineski, from Discovery Photo Tours,
Yep.
Jumping on for a chat later on about I don't know what because we haven't thought of it yet.
Right.
Also because we haven't recorded the episode.
We haven't recorded that bit yet, no.
Oh, we don't know what he's going to say. But I'm sure it's going to be epic. Well, we will be.
Yes.
And by we, will, I mean I. Will be right. Epic. And Ken will be here too.
Fantastic.
And if we're lucky, if this entrance to the episode hasn't put any new listeners off,
yeah.
We may get, when Ken promotes it, we may get a bunch of new listeners.
Oh, cool.
But the intro to the episode may have put them off.
Right.
So just if you're new to the podcast, we are one of the world's longest running podcasts.
And you haven't tuned out yet.
That's right, because we have a low threshold of pain,
yep.
And we don't take ourselves overly Bruce doesn't take himself over seriously, but we'd like you to stay for more than this episode.
And we would be one of the, I reckon, in the top three of longest-running photography podcasts.
But we're certainly number one in Pakistan.
Fantastic.
We can say that much, like, at least. You
know? Tom Waits, big in Japan.
And as our lovely listener last week said, of all the podcasts he listens to, we're it.
Yes.
It was something like that. I haven't got the notes here. So if you're new, welcome.
Yep.
We really encourage people to send in stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Saves us doing any work.
That's right.
Starters, which is if you want the show to keep on going, that's really important. And I mean, yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I put out a fairly
vocal
beep that message, telling people to send stuff in, and I'm glad it's worked so well.
Well, we've got a few things this week. Yeah.
Where to? Obviously, I don't check anything.
David Marland, Gaz, Rob Coates, Steve Peters, Adam Davidson.
I was kind of thinking
Glenn Lavender.
Someone different than us. From the normal half.
Right.
The normal half a dozen.
Well, Gaz is new. Don't know who Gaz is.
Well, we've got a Gaz. I haven't seen this. Shall we start? We can talk about him.
Gaz just commented on the show notes for last week's episode and said, enjoyable show as always. What is the make and model of the 70-200 f4 lens you're talking about? I couldn't remember from the last show. Thanks.
Fabulous. Well, first up, let's not call this the George Georgiadis episode. Let's call it the Gaz, the George Georgiadis episode. The Gaz, not the George Georgiadis episode.
It'll be the Gaz George G conflict. That's what it'll be.
There we go. Some of those battles, you know, the lip sync battles and stuff. So the 70-200 you were talking about, of course, was the Sony.
Yeah.
Which, of course,
and that's really all there is to tell you about it.
But I also mentioned, that I really enjoy using, of course, me as a Tamron ambassador. I really enjoy the Tamron 70-200. 70-210. In fact, you know, this is spur of the moment thinking. I've been sitting there racking my head a little bit today about weight allowances for Africa.
Yep.
Where we have just a mere 15 kilos of allowable carry, all luggage, clothing,
gear, the whole
lot. I mean, my carry-on camera bag weighs 70 kilos of gear, and that's including about 5 or 6 kilos of stuff in the suitcase normally.
Yep.
So my normal photo tour gear is about 22, 23 kilos of gear, which I've got to nut that down to under 15 and have clothes. Well, just right then and there, a small problem solved. I'm not going to take my 70-200 2.8.
Yep.
I'm going to take my 70-210 f4.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a fair weight drop off. And I've been sort of crossing my mind all week about, do I take my 15-30 Tamron or the 17-35?
Right.
And bang, straight away, the 17-35 is a third of the weight in size.
Yep.
And it takes filters easily. So another problem solved. So to Africa, 17-35, 70-210, and my 150-600. That's a pretty good kit.
Yeah.
And I would say the 70-210 and the 17-35 combined would weigh about the same as my 70-200 2.8.
Yeah, right.
It's pretty good.
Crazy.
That's some big pluses there. So, you know, we're not all about having to have the most expensive 2.8 lenses all the time. It's not, you know, I find the f4 incredibly sharp, as do you.
Yeah.
Beautiful if it's a thing that interests you. Beautiful bouquets in the background, flower bouquets.
That's it.
If that's the type of photography you do.
Yep.
And everything you need. And if you're not shooting it, it's one shutter speed difference between a f4 and a 2.8.
Yep.
So you know, if you're shooting in low light, if you've got a fairly modern camera, difference between 3200 and 6400 ISO to get that shutter speed back,
yeah,
shouldn't be too much of an issue.
No. Certainly not for me.
Your cameras with your, once again, if it's any new listeners, your new Sony A7 R3, wasn't it you got?
No, just the A7 III.
Okay.
So the R3 is a 42 megapixel sensor and the A7 III is a 24 megapixel. And I did not want 42 megapixel.
For what reason?
I don't need that much resolution, and I didn't want to have to deal with the bigger file sizes and the longer ingest times.
Now, probably more importantly than either of those things, is that it's harder to get a 42 megapixel image sharp than it's a 24 megapixel.
That makes sense.
You see more issues.
I have heard that.
A little bit of movement, a little bit of whatever it may be, it is more noticeable on a 42 than a 24.
Yep.
So, you're paying less money.
Yep.
You're getting ample files. I mean, how big are the files you're getting out of it, Bruce?
They're around about 40 megs for a RAW file.
I mean, that's huge, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's monstrous.
But I've been putting up with that for 9 years, and I'm kind of used to that. But the idea of going to something that was 42 megapixels, which would deliver around about a 75 megabyte RAW file, is like, no, that is just insane. And no one needs that much resolution. So, I was more than happy to stay with a 24 megapixel sensor.
Yeah. And the lovely 7210, so yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that you should bring up the issue of weight allowances for your Africa trip, because one of the stories that was sent in this week was from Steve Peters, and this was from Inside Imaging.
He makes a nice cheesecake.
So you have told us.
Have I?
Yes.
I mean, he'd said if he was a decent bloke, he'd send them down to.
Exactly. That was exactly my next comment.
It's only 1,000 or so, 1,500 kilometres or whatever distance.
Well, from me to him, but it's twice that to you. I'll tell you what, he could send it to me, I'll eat half and then I'll send the other half on to you. How's that? But anyway, he sent us a story from insideimaging.com.au about how the AIPP has weighed in on the airline bag policy.
Yes, that's right. I've got sent that.
Yeah. I see it was on your list as well.
No. I mean, the AIPP sent it to me to proof it and ask if there's anything they'd missed to put on. They asked my advice to see if there's anything.
Yeah, and I thought very good to see them, going to bat on behalf of professional photographers. Admittedly, they're looking after photographers who have got accreditation to at least one professional photographic body, even if it's not the AIPP. It's not so much for just the average Joe Blow that wants to cart a bunch of
special dispensation, basically.
Yeah.
For any card-carrying member. And that would, of course, give fair incentive to anyone to become a member if they manage to pull it off.
Yeah, for sure.
So the issue for anyone who's not been following along here in Australia, all our airlines are now weighing carry-on bags to keep them under 7 kilos.
Yeah.
So about 15 pounds. Yeah. Now, as I just mentioned before, my average carry-on is 17 kilos.
Yeah.
So, I mean, straight away, we've got some issues,
And if you're like me and most photographers that I know, most of us do not want to see our camera gear going in the hold underneath the plane.
No.
I could maybe settle for wrapping all my lenses up inside my clothing so that they're sort of shock-absorbed and then just taking the camera body into the cabin with me.
Yeah. Yeah,
And that's probably what I'm going to have to do when we go to Sri Lanka. But it means that I don't have I suppose I could keep one lens with me so I can shoot last thing going onto the plane, first thing coming off the plane. But,
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the gist of what AIPP, once again, the Australian Institute of Professional Photographers, for those who don't know, was to get two bags, an extra bag of 7 kilos for working photographers.
Yep.
So we're not trying to get one bag that now still weighs 14 kilos, which is a health hazard if it falls.
Yep.
But it's a matter of having, which I think is a reasonable compromise.
I think that's a very reasonable request on the part of the AIPP, and I hope the airlines come to the party.
I doubt it.
Yeah. Well, you never know.
Yeah, I doubt it. I mean, the problem is it's hard enough to get one company to agree to something, let alone multiple companies. Yeah, there's not like an industry body.
Well, there's CASA. I don't know if CASA would have any weight in that regard, because it's more than likely individual airline policy rather than industry policy. But hopefully, the AIPP can talk to CASA and try and get them to coerce all of the airlines to agree to the same policy.
Yeah.
Because there was something in the story, I'm kind of skimming through it at the moment, but there was something in there about how, you know, musicians and the like, they receive special dispensation. Oh, and professional sports people, you know, like cricketers with their, you know, their kit bags of cricketing gear and that sort of stuff, they get dispensation.
That would go under the hold.
That would go under the hold, I know, but...
A wooden bat, yeah. But, anyway, but musicians, definitely, like, you know,
yeah. Yeah, guitars and...
You're not going to put your $10,000
Stradivarius violin,
guitar, your flute, Stradivarius flute, in. You know, I mean, I think you got problems with your bigger instruments, though, more like your cellos.
Yes,
I mean your double bass is going to have some trouble. Regardless, that's never done in old. Yeah. I mean, that's never going on board.
So I've tried to get my double bass into an overhead compartment, and it just doesn't fit.
I think you have to buy a second seat for it. Yeah,
that's right. Anyway, David Marlin sent us a little email and said, "Hi guys, Topaz Labs have just released this product, a bit of reverse engineering, but perhaps offers the opportunity to retrieve some detail from JPEGs, particularly from point and shoots or phones. Topaz have been putting out a number of new post-processing products using AI, part of the computational photography we're seeing. Regards, David." And the link will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check this out. Basically, what they're touting is AI-driven software that can take a compressed JPEG and pretty accurately assess what the raw file would have looked like before it was compressed to a JPEG and rebuild the data from the compressed JPEG. That is pretty amazing stuff. If the reality lives up to the promise, this will be amazing technology. Yeah, well worth
it. So then everyone will just shoot in JPEG and not... No,
Well, professionals won't, but, you know... Imagine.
Well, why wouldn't they? If they can just adjust them back to RAW later, why? Once again, talking about size of files and everything else, if it has exactly the same effect, why would you bother?
Yeah, but is it going to be exactly the same as the original RAW?
That's why I said if it has the same.
Yeah. So I doubt that it'll ever be a perfect reproduction, but if they can get 90% of the way there, then that's a massive leap forward.
Well, I mean, it's because I only pretty much use Photoshop. I don't use Lightroom. I use Lightroom Mobile, like on my phone, but nothing, not anywhere else. I'll often open my JPEGs in the Camera Raw filter and use all the sliders as if it was a RAW file.
Right.
So it's kind of has, but obviously not with the same amount of data a RAW file would have because it's a JPEG. So.
Yeah.
But, I can understand the process of why you'd want to have all those extra controls and stuff, so...
Yeah.
Nice.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Rob Coates wrote in and said, "Excellent episode. Its 27-minute brevity gave me the chance to catch up on 33 minutes of staring blankly out the window. A real bonus. Many thanks."
There you go, dude. So don't say we're not a giving kind of workshop. Podcast.
That's right. And Adam sent us a story. 500px bans photographer because his photos were not photographic enough. This is a really interesting story because the guy goes to great lengths to achieve what appear to be heavily manipulated images, but he's actually achieving them in camera.
Whoa.
And, you know, and he's reached out to 500px and gone, "Look, I can give you the raw files. I can show you that these are straight out of camera," and they're not listening to him. They've basically just looked at the images and gone, "Nut, they're post-processed, they're not photographs, and we've closed your account." Now, hopefully, you know, with a bit of exposure of this story via podcasts like this, maybe someone at 500px will, you know, sort of step in and overturn that decision because it's a...
I'm thinking you more mean by podcast that people listen to.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So, it's a bit rough, you know, when a guy obviously got immense talent to be able to pull off these images in camera and then gets shot in the foot for supposedly manipulating images when he really hasn't. So kind of feel for the guy. So what do you got on your list?
Me, nothing.
Right.
Excellent. Oh, I do. I lie a bit. I'm using a new computer today.
Right.
As we've discussed before.
What type of new computer are you using?
I finally got my Microsoft Surface Pro to play nice and actually start working again.
Right.
Which is always a good thing.
Yeah.
So I was having a little trouble getting my slide at work to go back up to remember what I'd post up there. Now, I put an article out here on an interview with the CEO of Canon.
Yeah.
Who says that he sees the market to shrink to just 5 to 6 million cameras sales worldwide by 2020, so next year.
Yeah. A 50% decline.
In 12 months, yeah. And whilst that is alarming, what I thought was possibly more alarming, especially for us Canon users, was kind of the reason why they've only brought out the one mirrorless camera is because they aren't going to bother doing anything.
Really?
Reading between the lines, they're going, well, hey, there's not enough camera sales to make it worthwhile.
Wow.
There's not enough camera sales to bother all the cost to research and develop.
The R&D,
We're certainly not going to go into all this mirrorless that everyone's already got stuff, and for such a shrinking market, why bother? And why bother updating anything to do with – this is once again, this is me reading between the lines.
Yep.
Why bother really upgrading the 5D or the 1DX series for a massively shrinking market, which they say is going to stop at about 5 to 6 million. It's not going to drop down half of that again and half of that again. And they're going to be putting a lot more of their effort into industrial use.
Right.
Which means Canon as we know it.
Yeah.
Maybe not doing too much going forward. There might be we already know, their compact cameras have pretty much disappeared. Does that mean they're going to one or two SLRs and everything else disappears as well in the next 2 or 3 years?
Wow.
So for me, it's a very big watch this space kind of thing.
Yeah. And as you say, a pretty scary proposition for anyone who's, heavily invested as a professional photographer in the Canon ecosystem.
Yeah.
The prospect of declining quantity of new bodies and therefore, by extension, a declining quantity of new lenses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
That really sort of struck me as an interesting thing. Olympus introduced a new SLR.
Just before we move on, the thing about this story that sort of, as you were explaining that story and as I was listening, I was thinking, this sounds like Kodak all over again, Canon saw what Sony was doing 5-6 years ago and ignored it. And Kodak was guilty of the same thing. They turned their nose up at the concept of digital photography and tried to maintain a film-only business. And by the time they realized their folly, it was too late to do anything about it.
Oh, that's one way to look at it. Yeah. I look at it exactly the opposite.
Which is?
Canon was so savvy to realize that it was a massively dwindling market, then what was the point of putting all that money into trying to develop mirrorless cameras when they were starting to take off, knowing that they're putting all that money that they'd probably never recoup?
I don't know.
Because, Kodak didn't invest in a massively, massively inflating industry.
Yeah.
Canon are refusing to invest in a massively deflating industry. It's a huge difference.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
So Canon is saying, well, hey, yeah, maybe the future is mirrorless, but we just don't want to play.
Yeah.
Because what's the point? Yeah. We'll put a token camera out just to placate the masses.
The dwindling masses.
Yeah, but we're not gonna come out with a full range. We're not gonna do like Sony do with how many full frame cameras do they have? Six? Something like that?
I don't know.
Yeah, no, lost track.
Yeah.
But that's it. To me it's saying, well, yeah, this is not a growth industry. This isn't we're choosing to not invest in an industry that's going backwards rapidly.
Fair enough.
Yeah, let's go find somewhere else to put our money that might be expanding.
Yeah.
And look, if I was Canon, I'd be Canon Smart Home.
Right.
I mean, optics in the smart home is going to be huge going forward.
Why the combination of optics and smart home?
Well, when you walk into rooms and it needs to see you, it recognizes you, see who you want. Let's say you walk into a house, your house, it recognizes who's come home.
Yep.
By seeing you, by facial recognition, which then sets on the temperature that you like or turns on the room that you would normally go in, that recognizes you and your preferences.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So there's going to be a lot of native optics. Now, security, home security, all linked in and connected together. There's a lot of need for – there's a lot of growth in smart home. And remember, they're an electronics company, not necessarily just an optics company. So there's plenty of opportunity to get into the connected home environment.
Yep.
And that's somewhere I think everyone would agree is going to be massively changed. The way a home is used is going to be massively changed in 10 years.
Oh, without a doubt.
So, yeah, if you want to get into a growth market, Canon, you know, there's one.
Fair enough.
And there's some synergy to the businesses you've already got.
Yeah.
Yeah, with printers, with optics, with screens, with there's lots of stuff there that they're already doing.
Yeah.
With memory, with I can see it. Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
But, so
cool.
So Olympus have introduced a new camera this week. Aimed at the sports market, which is really good. I mean, it's just like 18 frames a second.
I call this the Omdemics.
Omdemics, yeah. That's perfect.
The Olympus Omdemics. For those who don't know, it's the OMD-EM1X. So I'm just calling it the Omdemics. It's a bit crazy, isn't it?
It's crazy, but look, it looks, as part of the whole Olympus ecosystem, it looks pretty good. And if you're into that sort of sports stuff, but the reason I sort of singled it out is, we've known that Sony have had eye detection for a while, eye detection focus.
Yep.
Well, the Olympus now has car, plane. So because it's aimed at sports.
Oh, right.
It's now kind of recognizing the type of objects you're photographing, the type of sports you're photographing, and putting its power, its focusing power, whatever it may be, to that style of photography.
That makes perfect sense.
Does to me too.
Yeah,
makes perfect sense. So that's kind of cool.
You know, because if you're, you know, just as one random example, if you're shooting motorsports and
a random example,
and you're on a blind corner where the cars are just coming into view with only, you know, hundredths of seconds of an opportunity to actually get an image, then, you know, having an autofocus system that says, oh, yes, that's the thing that we're trying to capture all of the time makes perfect sense.
And tracking focus, obviously, is it just tracking as you're panning or whatever?
Yeah.
Imagine how much better your panning focus would be if it's locking in.
Yeah. Nice.
Pretty cool. And so to follow that through, they're also working on a new lens.
Okay.
A 150 to 400.
Nice.
But remembering those numbers doubled in 35mm terminology. So that's a 300 to 800mm lens.
Right. I meant to ask, what was the sensor size on that camera body? Because it looked very tiny.
It's micro four thirds, same as all sensors.
Right, okay. And so it's a 2x multiplier, is it?
Yeah, so 2x multiplier. So they're 150 to 400, 4.5, mind you.
Yeah.
It's equivalent to 300 to 800, 4.5.
That's massive.
And fast. But it's also got a built-in 1.25 times teleconverter.
Whoa.
Okay, which would take it equivalent to 1,000mm.
Yeah.
Was that 1,000mm? It'd be f5.3 or something on those kind of lines.
Wow.
Which is quite astounding, isn't it?
That's a great wildlife lens.
Yeah. Apparently, there's also a combination that they'll have a 2x teleconverter optional to come with it as well.
Wow.
Which would make it a 2,000mm focal lens.
That's crazy. That is crazy.
So, super optics. It's amazing what people are coming out with, I tell you.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Now, I chuckled.
Right.
I chuckled at this next one. Panoram is the name of the app.
Right.
And Panoram is an app that chops up your panoramas. So it's the opposite of a stitching app.
Right.
Which I had to think, well, that's kind of bizarre. So it chops up your panoramas to be the right size for Instagram or, not the live, the stories, that's the word.
Oh, okay.
Your Instagram stories and your Facebook stories. So you go out and shoot this lovely panorama. You do all the work to get it nicely stitched together. And then you use an app to chop it apart again, which I thought,
I've just Googled it, and I'm only finding panorama apps. So how's it spelt?
Panoram, without the A on there, so no panorama. Yeah,
that's what I thought, but Google's not giving me an app, like a link for it.
How about panoram.app?
Oh, okay.
.app.
Right.
That could be a web app.
Right. Interesting.
So welcome to the Panoram mobile app. Oh, well. It'll turn your panoramic pictures into a three-slide story in just two easy steps. Well, I guess that's if you're doing it for a like an Instagram story. But I just thought it was ironic that you now want to chop up your panoramas.
Yeah, and just to warn anyone that's thinking of looking at that, it's iOS only.
Oh, diddums.
Yeah.
Welcome to the room. A little mention there about Tamron USA. I've just become officially a Tamron USA ambassador, not just Tamron Australia.
Nice.
So they've included me and the lovely Alex Kearns from Western Australia, the two only international ambassadors in America.
Wow.
which is rather nice.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm also announcing, as long as it comes together, I'm on the early stages, I'm going to do a tour to Holi in March next year, in 2020. Right. So into India, into the non-tourist towns of Mathura and Vrindavan.
Okay.
Vrindavan is the birthplace of Krishna, where the main temple is absolutely nutso on the festival of Holi. Now, so for Holi, for those that know, it's the colour festival, the powder.
Yep.
And this town just goes, I mean, people travel from all over, their pilgrimage all from all over India to go to this town for Holi.
Yep.
And it is intensely fantastic, but intense. So I'm putting on, I'm going to take a small group because it's too, you can't manage a big group. And the tour's going to be basically, we're going to go to Delhi for a couple of days.
Yep.
We're going to hit some highlights of Delhi. Then we're going to go to Varanasi, which is a must for any photographer in the world. But one of the things I'm trying to organize for a Varanasi trip is to meet up with a whole bunch of local Varanasi Indian photographers. And they're going to take us out. They're going to take us out for an afternoon. And that's, you know, wonderful sharing. But some of these guys, I said, are phenomenal shooters. I've said it in the past.
Yep.
Using some really rudimentary gear and sometimes, but the images are fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we're going to go to Vrindavan and Mathura for the Holi festival.
Nice.
I'll be putting on a couple of day extension down to Jodhpur, the blue city, if anyone wants to follow on to that. So it's only five or six people, fairly brave souls. You know, Delhi, Varanasi, that can be a bit confronting if you're not used to those sort of countries with the amount of people, the noise, the chaos, the driving. In Varanasi with the burning bodies, you know, it can be.
Say what?
The burning ghats, where they incinerate the bodies on the side of the Ganges.
Oh, okay.
So you get to go, yeah, you can go into those places and view that. You can't photograph in there, but yep. You can. You've got to pay money, and we don't do that.
Right.
And it's also a bit of respect, too.
Yeah.
But you're not supposed to do it, but there's some unscrupulous operators there who will charge to take you in and take photos.
Right.
So the burning ghats can be a little bit confronting to some people. I've never found them, and I'm fairly squeamish. I've never found them to be anything overly concerning. I've never gone all the way in because that doesn't interest me.
Sure.
But I've sort of stood on the boat watching it from a boat, yep. And it is what it is. So those ones are confronting only in the normal travel way. Holi in Vrindavan, people can get to a bit of a frenzy. There's quite a rush of humanity, and at times there can be a bit of a human crush at times. It can get a little bit claustrophobic.
Yep.
And then on the actual morning of Holi, some of the young lads drink a little bit too much and they can get a little bit stupid. So right. For that one day where they get a bit stupid, my tour will have a security guard on that day.
Wow.
If it's an all-male tour, I'm not going to worry about that because they're not interested in men when they've had a bit to drink. It's the women, especially the white women, they can get a little bit more
touchy-feely.
A little bit grabby. So we'll have if we have any females want to come along, we'll have two guides on that day per five or six of us. And if there's two women, let's say, and three or four men, the guides will stay with the ladies for the whole day and protect
them.
Well, and it's really only about a 3-hour period because it's fabulous. The whole day of Holi is great. You wake up in the morning about 6 o'clock and get out, and people are celebrating out in the streets.
Yeah,
the families are there. The kids are there. They're partying. They're having food. They're sharing food. They're sharing tea and celebrating beautifully,
Yeah, right.
And then come about 7:30, the ladies and the kids start to sort of get less and less, and it's more the men and the younger men, the 20s, the late teens.
Yeah.
And the older men about 8 o'clock start to disappear, and then it's just the young idiots, and they drink so much they get a bit stupid.
Yep.
But come about midday, they've all had too much to drink, they all sort of pass out. And it's actually really quiet after that.
Right.
So it's just that morning. But the way Holi works is it's several days of lead up. There's like a different ceremonies and different meanings to each day.
Right.
Before Holi. So we'll be in Vrindavan doing this stuff for the coming days, a few days before the actual ceremony itself, which is... It's notoriously hard to get information, so I haven't actually caught the itinerary completely finalised, but I hope to do that in the next 2 weeks. So if anyone wants to come along on a seriously cool photographic adventure to India, let me know, March next year.
Any further word on Alaska yet?
Alaska, no, that won't come until June. We won't have the info until June.
Right.
My offsider in America's got to go into the Inuit villages, talk to them, everything else, get all the logistics laid out and go from there. So that'll be June. That's when she's going in there.
Cool.
So to give you a little, during my research this week, as much research as I could do whilst the kids are on holidays, I thought, you know, I've always flown from Delhi to Varanasi. Wouldn't it be cool? Maybe a cool experience. I'm trying to give people great experiences on this trip. Maybe
catch a train.
Yes, it makes a thing. Yes, train.
Absolutely.
So I started looking it up, and here's the official info. It's going traveling from Delhi to Varanasi is no problem at all by train.
Fraught with danger.
Regular, reliable trains. They're fast. They're clean and efficient. Then it says zero daily trains go from Delhi to Varanasi.
Right.
But that number jumps up to 12 weekly.
Right. What?
Exactly. So zero trains go daily. If you look at it on a daily basis, there are no trains.
Right.
But if you look at it from a weekly basis, there's 12.
Right. Okay.
Just don't know where. So I went back to Cook and fly.
Oh, dear.
You just know straight away you're in a losing battle. You know? It's just take it easy. Let's fly. Let's keep ourselves fresh, and because I mean, India's not a tiring. Can be a bit tiring,
right?
Because you're out shooting for long periods of time. Like Varanasi, I mean, you're up well before sunrise. You're on the river just before sunrise, so you're there at like 5 a.m.
Yeah,
you might be shooting through to what's called the Aarti ceremony on the river until 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah, right.
Now, often there might be a couple of hour break during the day there, but it's still a long day and pretty exhausting. So, yeah, if you don't need to put your body through 12 hours of train travel overnight and you can fly there in an hour and a half, it kind of makes sense. So if it was myself, I'd be in it. I'd catch that no train daily and get there 12 times in a week or something. But, so holy March 2020.
Fantastic.
We'll be so next year, that means confirmed for next year, is the calving season for Tanzania.
Yep.
In February, March will be the holy. August will be Tanzania again for the Great Migration. June or July will be Alaska for the bears and Inuit.
Yeah.
Photo thing.
Nice.
So that's all officially on for next year. I might squeeze something else in there somewhere, but might do another Myanmar tour.
I was going to say there'll have to be a US trip in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I'll be in the US there, but they're not tours, they're workshops,
right,
or talks and that sort of stuff. So, but more than likely, hopefully another Myanmar tour next year because I love Myanmar. So, if you love Myanmar as well, come with me in December this year.
Right. Well, while we're talking about photo tours,
it's a good segue, wasn't it?
Yes, we should have a chat with Ken.
Ken who?
Ken, the guy with the can and the Esky.
Oh, Ken. He's a lovely guy. The funny thing about Ken, so I met Ken in Vietnam.
Right.
For like an hour one night and maybe 2 hours one morning we met at in Vietnam. And then we did a couple of Skype video talks together, just chatting and stuff.
Mm.
And I met up with him at Photo Plus in New York just recently in October last year. But that's all the time we've actually spent in each other's company.
Right.
And he's going to be with me in for at least 14 days in Tanzania in August.
Right.
He's a very gentle soul. He's a lovely guy.
Right.
He may not be at the end of it.
Well, let's have a chat with him and see what he's like today.
What are you going to ask him about?
No idea. Ken, welcome to Shutters Inc.
Pleasure to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Now, we have to ask straight away, is this the best podcast you're on right now?
Oh, my God. It's the best one I've been on in minutes. I swear to God. It's just
I'd like you to know, because we've announced it this episode, Ken, that apparently we're number one in Pakistan.
Oh, my God.
Which, you know, once again, clarification, number one in Pakistan for expatriate Australian photographers.
Yeah.
I think there's only one of them. But he does listen. And funny enough, Ken, he's coming to Tanzania with us. How's that for a segue?
Excellent. I was just about to ask if his name was also Bruce.
No. Well,
Everyone's a nominary Bruce down here.
That's right.
Right.
So welcome aboard. It's lovely to have you.
Thanks so much. I'm really pleased to be here.
So what is it that you do, Ken?
Well, for the last 10 years or so, I've been dedicating my time and my photography work to doing travel. And I've been having the time of my life doing it. I used to be a stock photographer, and then before that, I used to be a fashion photographer.
Chicken or beef?
A little bit of both.
Because there's a limited market. I'm thinking it's a limited market, but you know, nobody wants to branch out.
Stock, not livestock.
Oh, okay.
For your viewers who may not be clear on the concept.
Excellent.
We have listeners. We don't have viewers.
Yeah, that's right. I knew I was going to get corrected on that as soon as I said it.
Yes. And we like to think of our viewer in the single, yeah, as opposed, yeah, to, yeah, because that might be all that's out there.
So you've been doing photography tours as well.
Right. So that's been an interesting evolution from starting to do this travel work, and I've really enjoyed that.
This is excellent news. It means I no longer have to put up with Glyn. I can ditch him.
Well, unfortunately, no, because I have the good fortune of being able to work with Glyn at this point in time. So we're teaming up on some fun projects.
Can you say that again? Oh, I was a little bit quiet on this end. You have the good fortune of what?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting a little hoarse right now. It's I can't repeat myself. I have that kind of a tick. I'm sorry.
Shetland or Welsh?
Right. So it's been an interesting evolution to get to this point in terms of, you know, doing the travel work alone for several years and starting to get the chance to see the world and photograph, you know, beautiful places and interesting people, and really getting a more of a sense of adventure in my life as well, because that's what travel does. When, yeah, you start hitting the road, it seems to me that, you know, the longer you travel, the longer your travel list gets, because you meet other travelers. You get inspired by them. And, you know, I met Glyn in Vietnam, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, just having that sense of camaraderie on the road as well is something that brings travelers together, and especially those who also are photographers. I think that's a really cool part of this work that I'm doing now, is getting a chance not just to, you know, do the work myself, but to hang out with, you know, other pros and other amateur photographers who have the same
passion, also me.
Seeing the world. and also Glyn, you're right.
You say that normalizing passion. One of my favorite quotes from a customer, she emailed me after a workshop. She says, "I love coming to your workshops because it normalizes my passion. My family and friends don't get it, but when I'm with other like-minded people, I don't feel quite so weird."
Yeah,
you know?
Nice.
You know, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah. I get the same kind of sense from the guests that I have on my tours, and you know, we build this bond so quickly and develop, you know, a friendship, a kinship, a family, yeah, sense immediately, and everyone just feels, I'm with my people. And,
yeah, exactly. That's right. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm interested to know from both of you, have you ever been in on a tour in, you know, some country that's not your home country, and run into people who were just on holiday but who were keen photographers who ended up becoming clients?
I'm trying to convince a lady in Canada at the moment that I met on the banks of the Ganges in Varanasi to come to Tanzania with us.
Nice.
it's funny how it works out, you know?
Yeah. Ken?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it seems to happen more often than not that not that I get a chance to convince people to come with me. And I'm trying to think if that's actually, you know, last year in Tanzania, we met a lovely mother and daughter who were traveling in Zanzibar. And I've been speaking with them about having them come on a tour this year or next.
Nice.
I was just speaking with a friend I made in Italy, in Vernazza, in Cinque Terre. And so I met him and his wife about 3-4 years ago, and he was flying his drone. I was with my group leading a tour, and we just hit it off big, and I've even had the chance to hang out with them in Venice in California, and, you know, get a chance to keep in touch with them on a regular basis as well. So not only do you get a chance to make friends with the people who are on your tours, but with the people you meet as well. And, yeah, you know, not only that, but I'll meet other photographers who are running tours at the same time.
Yeah.
And that happens in Italy and Norway and other places. It's really cool.
Mm.
We had an amazing story. We're in, once again, in Varanasi, waiting for the aarti ceremony on the Ganges, and I was talking to a photo tour leader from China, and his group were all set up with all their big lenses, and they're all fine, so he didn't need any help. So we talked for a while, and then by chance, a couple of days later, we saw him at the Taj Mahal. And at this particular stage, they were cleaning two of the turrets for the Taj Mahal, so they were under scaffolding. So our group straight away are disappointed because half the Taj Mahal is, you know, under scaffolding. This guy comes running up and goes, "Look at this. Isn't this amazing? They only do this once every 5 years, and we're here to see it." So, you know, it's all about perception and experience.
And perspective. And stuff,
that attitude.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
I still get often frequent Facebook likes and comments from a man whose family, I took a photo of him and his family on a bridge overlooking a freeway in Los Angeles. He was there on holidays from like Portugal or something, and I was there running workshops and had a night off. So I took a family photo, gave him a card, and he's been following me for like 8 years.
Wow.
And he sent me a photo just a couple of days ago of him and his family up in the Alps, you know, in the snow. So it's amazing, as Ken says, the instant camaraderie with people from your own tribe.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, nice.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and even once in a while, we'll get recognized by people who, you know, either follow us in social media or know through the blog or other means that, you know, who you are and your work. And that's really nice as well. And immediately, again, you have something to talk about. And, you know, sometimes even end up going on little side journeys with these people because, you know, you didn't have anything to do that day on your travels other than what you were going to do. And that's, you know, photography, and that's what they're interested in too.
Yeah. I love meeting random people in the street like that who recognize you, because you get to talk about yourself for about 10 minutes, and then you get them to talk about then you get them to talk about you for 10 minutes. It's a good conversation to have.
Now, Ken, earlier in this episode, before we got you on the line, we were talking about how airlines around the world are becoming more and more restrictive on weight allowances inside the cabin. And as photographers with expensive gear, we generally don't like putting that gear in the suitcases that go under the airplane. Do you have any tips from your experience running photo tours on ways to, you know, either cut down on the weight of the stuff that you're carrying or just other ways to get around, you know, these restrictions?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that happens more than ever, and it's probably going to continue to happen with, you know, more weight restrictions coming and them wanting to charge. And it's not even them charging you for this. It's just the inconsiderate aspect of making you do something that is ridiculous. Because here's the thing, right? If you have carry-on that weighs over the amount, if you take whatever you have in your carry-on and put it in your pockets, then you're okay.
Yes.
But if it's in the bag, it's not okay.
Yeah.
So I've literally had this happen where we get to the counter and, you know, they weigh it and it's, oh, you can't bring that on. I'm like, okay. So I take the camera out, I put the strap on, I put it around my neck. I take a couple of lenses out, put them in my pockets. They weigh it. Are we fine? It's like, yep. Well, it still weighs the same on the plane. So, but now I may knock this camera into someone's head while I'm turning around. And okay, so no, it's just odd. And I think a lot of the times, unfortunately, it's it's people who work at the counter who have a Napoleon complex, who really just want to, you know, be the boss of a situation.
Give someone a little bit of power, and they want to use it. Yep.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's unfortunate that happens. So I try to keep my calm, which doesn't always work. So, you know, that I think is key. You have to be able to speak to the person, kindly explain to them what you're doing, you know, why you can't check the bag in. You know, I keep a video I have downloaded from YouTube on my phone as well, from an Air Canada video that went viral about people who, you know, gate check their luggage. And the people from Air Canada were throwing the luggage from high up above onto the ground below to put that underneath into the carriage of the plane. And, you know, that to me is just one way to say, I just can't trust that this is not going to happen. I'm sure it's not going to happen in your airline, but I need to get to where I'm going. This is a job for me. If my equipment doesn't arrive, you know, in good shape, then I can't do the work that I've gone to do, and someone's going to be liable for that. And are you willing? So you ask them if they're willing to sign an insurance paper for you that your equipment will get there, and if not, that they're going to be liable, not just for the cost of the equipment, but for the project that you're working on. And, you know, that could be tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of, you know, other people, you know, and time and effort and energy and all that. So that may work. If that doesn't work,
I love the idea of the form. The form's a good idea to have on hand. Yeah. So you're ready in the arm to say, okay, here, sign this. Yeah. And that's going to make people stop pretty quickly.
Right? Yeah.
Has to speak to a manager, to a supervisor, and that may get you to talk to someone who may be a little bit more considerate. But the key thing is, I think, at the very beginning, when you're going to the counter, is don't make it look like your bag is heavy.
Yeah.
And don't even tell them that you have it. If push it right up against the counter,
yep.
And if they ask you if you have anything to check, yes, your check bag, you put it on the scale and you weigh it and it goes through. Anything else, if you have like a laptop, little bag or something, show them that. And then just walk away with the other one. 99% of the time, that works for me. The other best way is if you're at the airport with somebody else.
Yeah.
Give them your bags.
Absolutely.
Go check in.
Yeah.
And then vice versa.
That's what I love when my wife drops me off. Drops me at the airport. I do exactly that. She holds the camera bag. I go up and check in. Then come back and get it. Until they say, we need to weigh your bag. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah. Because now every bag's weighed here in Australia now, Ken. So every onboard bag, and you have a maximum of 7 kilos. So,
yeah.
It's tough.
I'm waiting. Australia.
Yeah. I'm waiting for them to bring in.
That's the worst place in the world for
this. Right now it is, yeah. But I'm waiting for them to bring in total weight. So how much you personally weigh and how much your bags weigh, you've got a maximum allowance, you know. So if you're a big guy like myself, and because you know, my clothes are bigger, so therefore my clothes are heavier. I've got 200 pounds I'm allowed to take on a plane, including myself, you know. And anything over that, you have to lose a limb or something, you know. But it's going to get there. I mean, it's stupid that I, as a 250-pound man, get the same allowance as a 100-pound person. Yeah, you know, they're being disadvantaged, really. They're taking a lot less stuff on the plane than I am, weight-wise.
Yep.
They're changing the balance, especially on the smaller planes. They're changing the balance of the plane, the trim, as they like to call it, quite substantially. I've been asked to move around the plane many a times to change the trim of a plane.
Wow.
On these smaller flights, yeah. The pilots ask, we're flying nose down. Do you mind moving towards the back of the plane? That kind of stuff, you know. It's going to get more and more of an issue, it says, especially on the smaller regional flights and stuff.
Sure. So that I can understand. So like in Africa, when we do our safaris, we definitely have the small planes to contend with. And what we do there is we have our drivers take our big luggage and we just take our camera bags and a small overnight bag for that night. And the drivers will drive the long 9-hour drive to our next destination. We'll fly and we'll get there the next day. They leave the day before. So, you know, it makes sense to be able to do something like that when it's a small plane. But if it's, you know, a 777 or something or a Dreamliner or you know, come on. I mean, this just doesn't make any sense. And honestly, there should be some kind of special dispensation for people who are carrying sensitive equipment with them. And, you know, there's a big difference between that and someone trying to carry their big bag full of clothes and other things that just can be put under the plane with no negative repercussions whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, that's what I get the plane quicker.
Part of the rest of the story that we were covering earlier in this episode, Ken, is that the Australian Institute of Professional Photographers, the AIPP, is actually putting a case to the airlines at the moment saying that any photographer who is accredited to a professional photography body, and it doesn't even have to be the AIPP, but if they're carrying a card-carrying member of a professional photography organisation, that they should be allowed to take a second bag of no more than 7 kilos. So once again, you know, just keeping the weight limit to a given bag under that 7 kilo limit, but should be allowed to carry a second bag with their photography gear separate from their personal gear. Which Glenn and I both agree is a great idea, and I'm sure everyone listening probably thinks it's a fair and reasonable suggestion as well.
I don't even think the weight is enough when you look at it that way, because I'll be carrying an awful lot more than the 7 kilos you're talking about.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, fits into a small overhead compartment, then, you know, unless you're packing it with lead weight, you know, if it's lenses and cameras, yeah, okay, pack the rest of it in your checked-in bag to bring it down to the bare essentials of what you need to carry as sensitive equipment.
Yep.
So computer, hard drives, cameras, lenses. Let's leave it at that. The rest of it can go in your check bag.
The RIPP want 2 camera bags, so not 1 personal, 1 camera bag, Bruce. It's 2 7 kilos of camera gear.
Oh, right.
Because I said I can carry 18 to 20 kilos of camera gear in one bag, because my bag's big, that goes in the hold. Now, the problem isn't the weight as much as the weight falling out. So if the bag was to fall and hit someone under 7 kilos, they reckon people got a good chance of surviving. If it's 20 kilos, there's more chance of injury.
Yep.
So they're pushing for 2 7-kilo fully loaded camera bags to kind of
that
give people
sense.
A survival chance. Oh, which to me, that's reasonable. Yeah, I have no problem carrying 2 bags.
Yep.
If they wanted to do that, I think the airlines would be at least, you know, offering an olive branch, and that's fair.
Yeah.
And
there
are definitely camera bag systems that allow you to remove the interiors and even separate them in 2 soft-shelled bags that you can then place.
I think the biggest problem with that idea, though, is that most of these modern airplanes are designed, the overhead luggage space is designed to accommodate 1 bag, you know, per passenger. And I think if you then said, okay, well, photographers can carry 2 bags, then you're very quickly, you know, if you are unlucky enough to have a flight where there is a large percentage of photographers on board, you're very quickly going to run into a situation where there's not enough overhead luggage space for all of the bags that have been brought on board. So I can understand the airline's point of view from that side of the argument. So I don't know what the answer is. Maybe we need to...
Well, the answer is under seats. If the bag's small enough to go in the hold, it should be small enough to go under the seat.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, why doesn't, you know, Boeing or whoever else is building airplanes look into the idea of, instead of overhead compartments, under seat compartments? You know, have under the seat locker storage so that there is no opportunity for luggage to fall out and onto somebody's head.
You know, and there's not that many people on each flight that are doing this. So there could even be a special compartment in one section of the plane where there's a locked, you know,
cabinet. For all photography gear.
If you have a 600 millimeter lens or something like that, you know, that can't fit under a seat. Well, people do travel with this stuff.
And, yeah,
absolutely. You know, the same thing. It's like, what if someone's traveling with a viola that costs $500,000?
Yeah.
You know, I'd be very reticent as a musician to be carrying any kind of instrument like that that is, you know, irreplaceable. And that's far more valuable than any.
The number of stories that you can find on the interwebs about, you know, musicians who've had valuable instruments destroyed by airlines is just, you know, you could create a book out of it. It's ridiculous. So, yeah.
Anyway, enough of it. Like, it's just boring crap.
Well, give us another topic, Glenn.
Ken, okay, so that's you've had some experience traveling.
I've seen a little bit of the world.
You've seen a bit of the world. Are there any, like, must-dos that kind of keep you sane on a trip that, you know, okay, if I've got this stuff organized, then it helps me keep things smooth sailing?
Well, one would be making the false assumption from the very get-go that I'm actually sane.
But and competent. There.
Yeah. And competent, yeah, so... Planning is always, I think, something extremely vital that I try to do a great deal of before I go, and making sure that I have all my documents that are important to me, not just with regards to the trip itself, like airline tickets and passport and all that, but copies of all these things scanned and digitally stored in the cloud and on my phone as well, so that I can access all this stuff offline. But things also like insurance papers and business documents that I'm going to need. And for people like Glenn and myself, you know, who are running photography tours and workshops all over the world, we need to have, you know, client information, their schedules, their flight arrival times, all the kinds of things that we're going to need to be able to make sure that their trips are running smoothly as well. So plan. You can never do enough of that. And, you know, there's good software for it. So I use Evernote to keep everything basically in one place. I also use Google Docs for keeping PDFs and other things of that nature that are important to for me to be able to access. And that's also where I do most of my work in terms of the business that I run. And it's all up there in the cloud. So that's great. And a lot of that stuff is going to be available offline as well. I use TripIt for software for my itineraries for hotels and flights and things of that nature, because you basically can get all your information emailed to you from, let's say you're using Expedia or one of the airlines sends you your travel itinerary. You just forward that to TripIt, and into it goes right into your account, and within about a minute, you're going to get an email back with a PDF showing exactly what your whole itinerary is. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I use Kayak, which is a very similar product.
I write on the back of my hand with a pen.
Of course you do.
It's always with me. It's always with me. And unless I'm in the plane, it's never in the cloud. Boom, boom. That's thinking on the toe, is that? So another thing, Ken, and this is something I come across all the time with leading people anywhere, is managing expectations.
Absolutely.
So what are your thoughts and tips and ideas on that?
Well, since my tours are the best in the world, their expectations are extremely high. And
absolutely.
Honestly, it's not just about doing that with the expectations, but it's also about managing personalities when you're on the road, and making sure that, you know, you're not just there as a photographer, but you're there as someone who's supposed to be a leader, who's supposed to be providing all the basic services that people want. You're supposed to be there in case anything goes wrong. And you're fixing things as time goes by. There's always going to be things that go wrong, and that's on a daily basis when you're at home. So when you're with 15 people on the road, definitely there's going to be things that need to be taken care of, and it's a matter of making sure that that goes as seamless as possible, and that the people who, you know, have perhaps sometimes higher expectations, they're getting those met. And, you know, understandably too, there's going to be people who have different levels of travel experience.
Yeah.
And it's about explaining to those people who have less that this is kind of the way things work when you're on the road at times, and we have to go with the flow. So I don't like to give, for example, a full itinerary of what we're doing in a day.
Exactly. Exactly.
Then people have this thing where it's like, if
it's 10:01, it's 10 o'clock, we should. This people.
Ooh, and that's tough, because it also sets a bad mood for the group. And yet, if they're having the time of their life, and they didn't know that maybe you had to pull something because you made a judgment call that we're having so much fun at this one location that if we tried to rush to the next one, we would be spending more time in a bus or train or something else to be able to get to where we're going. Yeah. And again, you have to rely on the fact that you've got leaders there who have done this before, who know what they're doing, who know the locations and the activities that are on the itinerary, and that they're going to make sure that you're trying to have the best time of your life, regardless of what's going on.
Yeah, which is it's always a risk to leave something great for the potential that the next thing might be good.
Yeah. You know?
The opportunity to keep shooting great is something you've just got to go. You've got to go with the flow. You've got to have that flexibility. So I'm the same. I try not to map out a day other than generalities. The other thing I say at the beginning, the first day of every tour I'm on, I always say, expect things to go wrong and embrace the things that go wrong, because the things that go wrong is where the stories are at. There's no stories if everything goes fine. we went to the mosque and we took some nice photos and then we left and got a cup of tea. There's no story there, you know. I went to the mosque and there's all these birds and there's pigeons are flying everywhere and this pigeon got inside my camera bag and I couldn't, you know, there's a story when stuff goes wrong, you know.
Absolutely. It's your battle scars that you talk about that make, you know, the adventure part of it an actual adventure.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, again, you know. It's a great story started by someone eating a salad.
that ran the table at night of a photo tour when everyone sort of, yeah, that's when they're telling the stories. Yeah, that's where the stories are very rarely, oh, yes, we caught the latest plane and it flew, left on time and it arrived, actually arrived 2 minutes early. We were quite surprised. You know, it's not the most thrilling of stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. My last, sorry, go.
Yeah, the best ones are just the ones where you've lived through something, but also lived through it together with the rest of the group, and you can, you know, elbow each other in the ribs after and have a good gut laugh about it. Absolutely. I think that's the best. And then your photos actually mean something. When you look at those photos that you took that day, those are the stories that are going to come back to you, and you're going to just get this big grin from ear to ear. And then you're going to actually probably want to go and get onto Facebook or Messenger or something and contact those people so you could relive that again. Those are the moments I live for personally. I love having, you know, things that we live through.
Yeah, they're the moments, they're the memories, aren't they?
Yeah. Nice. Awesome.
I was talking to a guy the other day about sports photography, and I think this applies to more so to like things like an Africa tour. And he was saying, well, I can't get out very often to sporting events to practice becoming a sports photographer, but it's my goal. Do I have any tips? And so my tip to him was to get his camera and his lens and put some sports shows on the TV, and doesn't have to have a memory card in, but just practice timing by watching an event and thinking about when to press the button. And even if he doesn't have the camera with him, be thinking whilst you're watching that show, I would have shot then, I would have shot then, I would have gone from this angle, I would have shot that. And I think if people are watching safari videos and documentaries, put yourself in that position and think, well, what would I shoot? When would I press the button? Which moment and what's the story I'm trying to capture if I did press the button then? So it's pre-shooting, it's building this image bank of reflex of when to shoot. So when you're in front of the real thing, yeah, you've kind of got past that initial shock and you're ready to shoot. So it's just a little aside.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought of it that way. And that certainly has been something new for me in the last 3 years, is working on these safaris and getting a chance to spend now months of time during the course of a year in Africa photographing wildlife. And it's become, to me, just about the favorite thing I get to do during the course of the year, because magic happens at every turn. Or, you know, it doesn't, but, you know, the adrenaline is pumping and you're waiting until it's going to happen. So
the expectation.
And that's just fantastic. It is holding on, and, you know, you're basically holding your breath until something happens, and then you get this grand sense of accomplishment that you caught something that was a split second. Whereas we can stand in front of, you know, an incredible site, you know, whether it's the, you know, treasury in Petra or the Colosseum in Rome or something like that, it's not going anywhere. Yeah. You have time. You know, you have limited amount of time at blue hour and sunrise, sunset to be able to capture that perfect light. But this is completely different. And I just think that there's something magical about it, because also it's never going to be the same scene. Not today, not tomorrow, not for 1,000 years. You're going to have that, and it's going to be your photo and your photo only. And even if you're several people in that vehicle seeing the same thing, I'm always fascinated with how people see things in a different way, even from the same perspective.
Well, one of my favorite quotes from Jay Mazel, the New York photographer, is you can never photograph New York. You can only photograph your New York. So the one you see on that particular moment, that particular day, that the thing that happened may never happen again or may happen every single day, but that's your experience. And that's what I love about, as you said, that you can line five people up aiming at the same thing. They come back with five different looking photos. And there's a reflection on personality, and it's their vision of an event. It's fabulous to see that.
Yeah. I often get people, you know, emailing me or talking to me and saying, oh, you know, I see what you do, and you're living the life. I'm not living the life. I'm living my life. So Jay's right. You know, it's not the vision. It's your vision. It's not the life. It's my life. And, you know, people see that side of the life that I live on Facebook and social and whatnot, because I share the good things. I don't necessarily share the crappy things. And, you know, bad things do happen at times on the road, and it's tough to handle those things. And, you know, yet again, we live through them, and they make for great stories. And, you know, I wish I had a little bit more time to write on the blog these days, because there's a place where I would share a little bit more of the back end of all of this and the insight into, you know, the challenges that we face. And I'm honest about it when people meet me. It's just not something I necessarily want to celebrate on a daily basis by posting that on Facebook.
No, exactly. One of my favorite billboards of all time is this gorgeous supermodel reclining on a sofa in a lounge. And the headline is, somewhere in the world, someone is tired of sleeping with this person. it doesn't matter how glamorous anybody's life could appear to be. There are realities. There are aspects of every person's life that are magical, and there are aspects that are tough. You know, and as a dad of two young kids, it's tough being away for, you know, 3 or 4 months of the year from your children.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, there's the positive side of, hey, I'm away from my kids for 3 or 4 months. there's many ways to look at it. But so, yeah, so I mean, people see what we post. We post the moments that were fabulous, the moments that, not the 3 hours sitting there waiting for the sun to set so we got something to happen. Yeah, we don't post those. That if we were to do a video of that and put that video up with 3 hours standing there watching the sea, right? You know, people may change their mind somewhat.
But it's also about being there. And when you are there, it's a very different thing than looking at someone being there. Yeah, so if I'm standing in front of the sea waiting for, you know, that perfect seascape shot with the perfect clouds and sun and the waves, well, I don't care if it's 3 hours that I'm standing there, because that's really zen, and I can do it, and I feel at ease and at peace, and you know, I don't get a chance to do that when I'm sitting for 15 plus hours a day at my desk when I'm at home trying to put all these things together.
This is what it's all about. Yeah,
that's my compensation.
When I do Varanasi on my India tours, and we're on the boats and we're photographing the pilgrims coming down to bathe in the Ganges. At one point, I'll let people shoot for a while. Then I'll say, everyone put your cameras down. Stop and look. Just spend 2 minutes just staring at this. Yeah. Just savor the moment of where we are and what was. Don't be all fired up for the shot. Yeah, absorb the moment too, because the photograph without the moment means nothing.
Yeah.
So I say that at the beginning of every tour as well, the welcome dinner. That's one of the things I think is so important, is don't get caught up in the fact that you're here to take pictures. Live your moments, breathe, savor every second of it, and take the chance to really live this trip, because that's what's going to make your photographs special.
Nice.
I mean, when it comes back to managing expectations again, it's, well, how many great photos do you expect to get on this trip? I mean, what's your goal? Do you want 1,000 amazing photos? What are you going to do with them? My goal per year is to take 10 photos that I love.
Yeah.
And most years I don't get there.
Yeah, there's an Ansel Adam quote about something like that, and I think that's pretty much it. It's like, if you can take 10 good photos a year or something of that nature. But, you know, aim low in terms of that, but have a very high standard of what it is that you love.
Yeah. We take lots of really good. Yeah. But the ones that speak to you, the ones that when you look at it, your just heart swells. Not, oh, that's my normal stuff that I do all the time. You know, so when you come on tour on a trip, managing that expectation, how many great photos do you really need to come back from this trip with? If you came back with five, would you be happy? You know, five amazing photos from Africa would be five incredible photos.
Sure. Especially if they're selfies of me.
You would.
Ken, it's been great to have you on the podcast. Where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me online at discoverypphototours.com, which is where I run all my photography tours. And Glenn and I are going to be running African safaris this year in August. So we'd love to see anybody who's interested give us a shout through the Discovery Photo Tour site. There's a contact page there. We're also looking at teaming up next year and several other projects as well. I'm excited about that. So we're running tours later this year in Italy and in Myanmar and Jordan and Tanzania and Antarctica, actually, in November as well. So I'm really thrilled about that.
That'd be excellent. That'd be a lot of fun.
So are the ones that we still have a little bit of room on. And you can, you know, just type in my last name into Instagram or Facebook, and you can find me in those places as well. And my blog can be found at blog.kenkamineski.com.
Fantastic. We'll put some links in the show notes anyway. So
definitely. Well, mate, thank you for joining us. It's been great to have a chat. And
I'd like to say it's been a pleasure having you on.
You'd like to.
I'd like to say it's been a pleasure having you on, yes.
Well, I see how it is.
Don't worry, he's like that with me as well.
You have to think on that one.
All right. Well, that will do it for this episode. And I guess I'll, Ken, I'll no doubt talk to you at some point in the future. And Glenn, I'll catch you next week.
Absolutely. I'll see you in Tanzania, Ken.
See ya. Awesome. Take care, gentlemen.
Bye.
Bye.
Shudders Inc. Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@shuddersincpodcast.com.